The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly FA Cup special. And after all the time we spent dragging Mark Albrighton from the underrated abyss, he handballs Newport into the fourth round of the FA Cup. Victory 2 for Oldham, cliche alert, a fairy tale for their caretaker manager. Cardiff, Huddersfield and Sheffield United all go out to lower league opposition, while City and Spurs both score 7, brackets 7. Elsewhere, Wayne Hennessy stars in explanation of the season. A Blackpool fan sits on the Arsenal team bus. Jason McAteer is wronged by the evil Michael Owen in a game of five-a-side. All that plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Welcome, Sam Diss from Mundial Magazine. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks.
How's the new year at Mundial?
It's been pretty good, I think. I was just saying to Barry before we come on air that I barely left the house for about 3 weeks, so it's quite weird being back in sort of civilised society.
Well, you've got dressed at least, so you know, it's very, I'm impressed.
It's always nice to get dressed, even when you're at home. I don't wear socks anyway, so this is fine. It's nearly dressed. It's mostly dressed.
No, there are no socks. It's January, Barry, and there is a grown man not wearing socks.
It's mild. It's a mild day.
Your thoughts, please, Dinosaur Glendenning?
Oh, game's gone, Max.
Hey, Mark Langdon.
Hi, Mac. You okay?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. The last time you were on, people absolutely mesmerised by your intake of vegetables, or lack thereof, and we'll get to that.
I might bring out a January DVD, How to Eat Like Mark Langdon.
Well, listen, we'll save it for the end because this is more about the football, but people were more engaged by the fact you hadn't eaten a carrot since 1987, frankly, last time. So the FA Cup, I mean, Saturday wasn't that exciting, and then actually there were some good upsets on Sunday. Should we start with Newport's win over Leicester? Because it had everything, Sam, and I really enjoyed it. And by the end, I was, you know, I was a Newport fan by the end.
Oh, I'd fully bought into the Newport dream. I think when Leicester equalised, you could kind of see it turning, and I was a bit like, this is all kind of going to go tits up now. But then as soon as they got the penalty, I was fully jumping up in the air, fully paid up member, going to move to Newport now. And yeah, I'm bang into it. I think we can talk about sort of like the over romanticisation of the FA Cup, but that was like, that's what you watch it for. Exactly,
totally.
That.
Baz?
Yeah, Leicester didn't take it particularly seriously. Claude Puel didn't pick Jamie Vardy or Kasper Schmeichel, among other changes he made. But I think the players he did pick had every right to be thoroughly ashamed of themselves by the end of the match. And that's what you want to see when a Premier League team gets beaten by, in this case, a team 74 places below them, I think. And Newport were well worth their win. They gave Tottenham a good game last season and were perhaps lucky to go out after a replay. And again, Rodney Parade proved quite an unforgiving place. I think just Premier League, it's the kind, one of those kind of grounds that Premier League team will go to and just don't like it. They're way out of their comfort zone, and so proved yesterday.
Mark, what was Mark Albrighton doing?
It was a poor decision, wasn't it, really, to jump up like that. I mean, he was playing in a slightly unfamiliar position by that stage, you know, because he'd moved to right back.
You don't forget Simpson, the laws of football, yeah, when you move position.
I mean, I disagree that I thought that Leicester actually had more than enough chances to win the game. I don't know if it was sort of, say, as shameful as, say, Fulham's defeat to Oldham, where their players didn't seem to try a leg at all. But it's still, the Leicester fans are really unhappy with Claude Puel for his decision. They were, even against Manchester City in the League Cup, when they took them to penalties. And it does come back to sort of the argument of, you know, what are these mid-table teams doing, you know, if they're not trying to win a cup competition.
I suppose that if you look over the last, was it 20 years or something, it's always a top four, top six team that wins the FA Cup. So by that definition, you can play your first team, but eventually you'll get beaten by someone else. But I tend to agree with you, Mark, that you're not going to get relegated. You could push for the Europa League, right? But that's tricky. And
then if you get in the Europa League, you play the same players that you played against Newport anyway.
Yeah, so you might as well win the cup and get in the Europa League, or give it a try at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just keeps the season going. I mean, you know, you know, we've sort of labelled it the Everton Cup, but I mean, in truth, that sort of finishing seventh, I mean, it's not that big a deal, is it, if you finish seventh, eighth, ninth or tenth? So, I mean, that does keep that season just going, you know, it keeps the fans interested, you know, they'd want to know who they've got in tonight's draw, and then the fourth round's at the end of the month, and, you know, there's enough poor teams in there to get another, you know, comfortable tie, and then you're only a couple of games from sort of Wembley. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Are you in agreement, Sam?
Yeah, totally. I mean, as a West Ham fan, I'd absolutely love a nice little run in the FA Cup. I think what's important to remember that Leicester didn't take the cup particularly seriously, but it's still a pretty good team that they've put out. Mm. And without any disrespect to Newport, who played, I mean, I'm not going to claim to have watched them many times this season, but it looked like they were playing out of their skin. And the two centre-halves, Fraser Franks and Mickey Dimitriou, which are two fantastic names as well, they both played brilliantly. But I do think that it's sort of like, that's what teams have always done. I think that they played a team that should have won. Mm. And they played, I mean, a handful of players who were there or thereabouts in their first team. So, like, can kind of see what Claude Puel is going for, because he's trusted his players and gone, well, you're good enough, so go and do it. And yeah, not playing Jamie Vardy, and yeah, they haven't got a midweek match or anything like that, and then probably not going to get relegated, and they're not really challenging for anything, and you'd like to see them do more, but I think it always comes down to the fact that they're Premier League players, and a lot of decent talent on the bench as well. Damari Gray coming on. They have more than enough. They just didn't do it.
Michael Flynn, the manager, was one of two managers to say Roy of the Rovers. The other one being the older manager. We'll come on to that. It's almost Roy of the Rovers stuff, managing to stay up, improving the position. First time beating a Premier League team for him as a manager, and he's done a brilliant job. Barry, you enjoyed the team sheet, didn't you?
Well, yes, whoever printed the team sheets at Newport did a brilliant job too, because they spelt Christian Fuchs's, or sorry, Christian Fuchs's name the way I said it originally, yeah. Which was a nice touch.
Apologies if you were offended, by the way. Barry just said Fuchs. Right, so Oldham won at Fulham, and you know, what you can't say about Leicester having to go to Newport, you can't say that about Fulham. They're at home, Mark.
Yes, I mean, they are in a relegation battle. I suppose that would be the excuse. But Claudio Ranieri offered none of that. I mean, he, you know, said he'd give the players an opportunity to prove him wrong and they should be in the team. They took the lead, and then I think that's the cardinal sin, really. For the Premier League team, if you get in front at home, I mean, there's no way you should be then losing to a League Two team. But I'm pleased that they did, because you know, the Tom Cairney dive that wasn't picked up by VAR was one of the most astonishing things I've seen in football this season. I've no idea how Lee Probert could watch that on a replay and sort of nod that was a penalty.
Did the defender sort of touch the
top of their foot?
Is quite a sensitive part of the foot. I mean, obviously it looked ridiculous, and I was watching the highlights, and I presumed I was just watching going, oh, well, this will be overturned. And then the ref goes, here's a penalty. I mean, I think VAR's great, because I actually find it really entertaining.
It's very fun. I mean, during the World Cup, lots of my favourite moments were everyone losing their minds at VAR. But I think that entire sequence of the VAR getting it wrong for, well, I mean, the first time that I can remember, and then Fulham bringing on undoubtedly their best player to miss a penalty, is just an astounding piece of play,
isn't it? Well, especially after what happened the last time Fulham had a penalty and he wasn't allowed to take it, and now it's like special teams. Mitrovic must have. I mean, what they really should have done was then subbed him immediately after. Immediately afterwards, having no luck with penalties. I mean, Ranieri afterwards, not happy, Barry. I didn't see the passion. I didn't see the desire.
Yeah, and he'd every right to be unhappy. If you look at who beat them, you know, Oldham were managed by a guy who's not only just interim manager of the first team, but he's only interim manager of the academy, and was promoted up after Frankie Bunn was dismissed on the back of a 6-1 or 6-0 defeat at the hands of Carlisle on the 26th of December. Pete Wilde, who is in charge now, if he hadn't been in the dugout, he'd have been in the away end. He'd already booked his ticket and his travel to the game with some mates. He's just an Oldham fan who's somehow ended up
brilliant, isn't it?
Masterminding victory over Premier League opposition in the FA Cup. So for him, it's what an occasion. And you know, the goal scorers for Oldham, Sam Sturridge, or Sturridge, as soon as the game ended, went back to Bournemouth, where he was on loan from Bournemouth. He's gone back there. Callum Lang scored the winner. Wasn't sure if he was going to be playing because he thought he might be recalled by Wigan from his loan spell. So it's very much sort of butcher baker, candlestick maker, and Fulham should be ashamed of themselves.
It sounds more like professional footballer loanees.
Well, yes, okay.
but look, I thought they played superbly, didn't they? This is the first time two top-flight sides have been knocked out of the FA Cup by teams from the fourth tier or below on the same day since January the 7th, 1989, when Middlesbrough were beaten by Grimsby and Coventry City were beaten by
Sutton United.
Correct. 1 point to Barry. Gillingham 1, Cardiff City 0. Were you surprised, Mark?
In terms of all of the kind of upsets, this was, I think, maybe one that you could have predicted. Neil Warnock made a lot of changes. He didn't seem that bothered by going out of the FA Cup. I spoke to a Gillingham fan yesterday. He said, "Oh, you must be really excited." And he said, "Oh, no, we need to pick up some league points." You know, what sort of attitude is that really to take towards the FA Cup? But, I mean, I think Warnock is now reverting.
Is he starting to crack?
He is. He had that pop at Liverpool, didn't he, for loaning Klein to Bournemouth.
I'm very disappointed with Nathaniel Klein at Liverpool. To see on TV he's gone to Bournemouth when I've been promised he's my player, for me, is a disgrace and a lack of class. He might have a point.
Is he not totally entitled to be annoyed and to air his grievance if that what he's saying is true?
Yes.
So I wouldn't suggest he's cracking.
But it comes quick on the heels of the bizarre complaint that he wanted all of the Cardiff's relegation rivals to have to play Tottenham at Wembley because that would be more difficult than if they had to play at Tottenham's new stadium, which didn't seem to make any sense.
Is it that we want Neil Warnock to be angry because, you know, it's the constants in life that make us understand the world, and an angry Neil Warnock is one of those constants, and he's been far too happy this year?
Always entertaining, Neil Warnock. I mean, there's very few managers where you go, "Oh, I'll actually watch them speaking about anything." Jose Mourinho had it, and Neil Warnock probably has it as well. And I don't think he's quite cracking, and I wouldn't say his head's gone, but he's certainly sort of like midway through. You can see another couple of things not really going his way, and then him having quite a wacky February.
I have a feeling maybe that he came into this campaign totally expecting Cardiff to get relegated, like everyone else, and now that they're actually shown there's a reasonably good chance they might stay up, the pressure is perhaps starting to get to him, because previously he didn't consider himself to be under any pressure. Now things are looking a bit rosier for them. He might be feeling the strain. But I like Neil Warnock, have to say, and I seem to be in a very small minority of people in that regard.
I'm not sure you are. I think everyone's had a stage where they didn't like him, but I think most people have been won round by him. He says, "I just wish we could go in front now and then. Somebody told me we've only been in front 94 minutes this season." I mean, Nathaniel Klein, if you are on the verge of signing for Cardiff and then Bournemouth come in, I mean, whether it's ethically the right thing to do, I would probably go to Bournemouth.
Yeah, and I suppose the Solanke deal, I mean, Bournemouth probably, if they're paying £19 million for an untested striker that's injured until February, you may be within your rights to say, "And you know, can we have something else chucked in?" I think when Warnock sees Klein's comments today, that Klein said he's gone to Bournemouth because Eddie Howe's a great manager, that may wind Warnock up a little bit more.
I think if Liverpool had agreed to send Klein to Cardiff, or Klein had spoken to Warnock, then perhaps just pick up the phone and go, "Look, I've had this offer, I'm going to take it because blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Sorry for wasting your time." You know, it's just common courtesy, isn't it? That clearly didn't happen. And I think that's his beef.
Bristol City 1, Huddersfield 0. A huge shock, Barry.
No, it really wasn't. I thoroughly expected Huddersfield to lose this game. They've now lost 9 in a row. David Wagner made 9 changes. People were saying, "Oh, if he'd fielded a full strength team and won, it might have helped them in the league." I don't think it would have. And I think their full strength team would probably have lost anyway. So I think Huddersfield are absolutely doomed. And I have a feeling David Wagner may get the bullet sooner rather than later.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I wondered if they would.
They're starting
with
him. To, you know, it's like watching The Walking Dead. They're just sleepwalking, zombie style.
Surely The Walking Dead is more entertaining as a show.
No, it depends which series you're watching. Okay. The one where Negan came to prominence, that was very. I would rather watch Huddersfield sleepwalk to relegation than watch, sit through that again.
So Huddersfield kind of Fulham out of the cup. Is that going to help them at all, do you reckon, Sam?
Probably won't help Huddersfield. Cardiff, it probably will help a little bit. I mean, they're looking a little bit leggy. Without saying they're probably within their rights to focus on the league. Probably within their rights to focus on the league.
Frank Lampard's Derby 2, Southampton 2. A couple for Nathan Redmond. Some lovely play from Tom Lawrence in the lead-up to Jack Marriott's goal and the goal himself. And he could have won it, Mark.
Yeah, I think Lawrence is a really quite exciting player. And he's definitely, I think, got the capabilities to get back up into the Premier League. It's just finding the consistency and also the goals, because there's been a lot of times when I've watched him, and it's just that final moment really for him. And also just on the Redmond side of things, I mean, he's somebody that people have been really excited about for a long time. He's played a lot for England under-21s, which is almost a backhanded compliment because you have to be good enough to reach a certain level, but then you don't go on and sort of take that natural path towards the senior team. But he's got 4 goals in his last 5 matches under Hasenhüttl, so he may be a player to watch in this year, really. There's definite talent in there, for sure.
Are you still excited about Nathan Redmond? I'm my personal excitement levels of Nathan Redmond have slipped.
Yeah.
Oh, he's only 24. So, I mean, I think there is still time for Redmond to fulfil, you know, the undoubted potential he's got.
That's interesting, though, from an England perspective, because you see how young the England midfield is and attacking players. You start to think, is 24 too old? To if you haven't staked your claim yet with someone like Sancho doing so well. I mean, that's perhaps a ridiculous thing to say, but...
It's a bit of a weird one. I guess it's sort of like the... I wouldn't have guessed he was 24. In my head, he's a lot older than that, just because we've become so used to seeing him play and that yeah, as you say, a very predictable cycle of, oh, he's good. I mean, he's not really doing it this game, but maybe he'll be good soon. And just you end up feeling quite contemptuous against him, probably unfairly. But
I wouldn't say I didn't hate him. I mean, you've taken level.
It's just not constantly disappointed in him. Like I'm up at night being like, I just want him to do better. No, but the thing is, I just want him to just have a run of form and to be able to show that he is a good player that we all know that he can be. But like, there's other players who have been doing it more regularly. So
I suppose
to Redmond.
No, it'd be an interesting experiment, which we can't do, is to take him out of that team and put him in a Liverpool or a Spurs and see how good he would be in a team that actually create lots more chances. Right?
Well, I mean, Southampton have been woeful in the attacking third for a long time, and now maybe he is part of that, but he could also point to maybe a lack of a tactical plan that there's been there for maybe the last couple of managers. And actually now they've got a coach that knows what he's doing, and that there's more adventure in their play, and he's been given license to get forward more, and they're scoring more goals for sure. And he's part of that.
Sheffield United 0, Barnet 1. Darren Curry in temporary charge of Barnet after John Steele went upstairs. They're 15th in the National League, and Barry, Chris Wilder did make 10 changes. But even still,
I would argue this was the shock of the round, to be honest. The team Chris Wilder put out should have been well capable of beating a team from the National League mid-table. And he was understandably furious afterwards. And he said that the Sheffield United fans should have booed more loudly. He said that his players shouldn't leave Bramall Lane through the main exit, that they should find some side door to slink out of, because they didn't deserve to walk out the main exit. He was very, very angry. Darren Curry, the Barnet, I think he's only interim manager at the moment, but he may well get the job on the back of this. He is a nephew of Tony Curry, who's Sheffield United, recently voted Sheffield United greatest player of all time and has a stand named after him at Bramall Lane and is a director at the club. So, another sort of romance story. But Chris Wilder's fury with his players was quite interesting.
And well done to Shaquille Coulthurst, Huber's a former Spurs youth player. He scored the penalty. And a brilliant save in the last minute from Mark Cousins as well.
It was, yeah, from Leon Clark. Coulthurst actually afterwards said he wants Arsenal away in the next round because he wants to beat them at the Emirates. So their confidence is flying. I actually spoke to one of Coulthurst's former managers when he went on loan from somewhere outside of Tottenham, and he said he's got a lot of skill and a lot of pace. He just can't finish, and we don't think we can coach him. And I just wonder how many players there are that kind of are at that Premier League sort of academy level and then just drop right the way down just because, you know, there's maybe just one thing lacking. And I mean, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer thinks you can teach finishing, and Jose Mourinho has said that you can't. And this manager was of the opinion you can't teach it as well.
I suppose what's interesting when you look at these matches is when you look at a squad like Barnet and you compare it to Sheffield United's reserve team, and we say, well, look, Sheffield United had definitely had enough. What are the margins between, you know, the margins between your top four teams and the middle of the Premier League, and the middle of the Premier League and the bottom? And like, how, because we all know all these footballers are footballers that when we were growing up playing, they were the absolute pinnacle, weren't they? And it's just interesting to see, to just know how good a Barnet player is in a relative term, right?
Yeah, and I think probably in 190 minutes, you know, they can reach. I mean, if you have a look at that Sheffield United team, a lot of them were kind of the League One side that went up, really, and, you know, they've since sort of progressed on. So, I mean, there probably are a lot of them Barnet players that on their day could sort of play to League One level, but it's finding that consistency to be able to do that, you know, over 2, 3, 4 years, I suppose, and that's what separates.
All right, well, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start in Blackpool. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start at Blackpool. Blackpool 0, Arsenal 3. The story is more about what happened off the pitch than on the pitch. Blackpool hosting a Premier League side sold just under 9,000 tickets for the game. The majority to away fans. We saw the same in the league, didn't we, when Sunderland went there just last week. The last time Arsenal came here in the Premier League, the attendance was just over 16,000. It's largely due to a boycott by fans in protest at the ownership of the club by the Oyston family. We can talk to Christine Seddon, the chairman of the Blackpool Supporters Trust. Christine, how are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks, apart from a bit of a cold and a croaky voice.
thanks so much for coming on, despite the voice. In the national media, we sort of say, oh, it's terrible what's happening at Blackpool with the Oyston family. We don't really know that much about it. Can you explain it to us?
I shall certainly try. Basically, we have what we believe are the worst owners in football. We have in Owen Oyston, with a gentleman who is a convicted rapist, which for us means he should fail the owner and director test. But the football authorities won't apply it retrospectively, and so we seem to be stuck with him. As has been reported many, many times, the money that came into Blackpool Football Club when we got into the Premier League was, you know, huge, certainly to a club like us, and it should have secured our future. But unfortunately, Mr. Oyston decided that he would rather line his own pockets, basically, and prioritise his own businesses. So this money was siphoned off. Which is just totally, totally unacceptable. The club and the community that it serves has gone into decline, and we, the fans, have been left feeling that we have no other option other than to boycott, to withhold our revenue and our presence. This, we feel, is the only way. It's a financial strategy to get him out of our football club.
Are the people in Blackpool divided over this? I read an article over the weekend saying, you know, that it's difficult because some families want to just take their, you know, they want to take their kids or they want to go to watch their local football team, and some obviously want to support the boycott. Has that been difficult?
It is difficult. Of course it is. I think when people say something's divided, you tend to think, you know, there's like it's equal 50-50. The vast majority of Blackpool fans are standing very firm behind this boycott. And we have done for, we're well into our fourth season now, which is actually a staggering piece of collective action. Of course, there are still people who go, but, you know, it's about 1,500 people now that attend on a regular basis. As a supporters trust, of course, we acknowledge people have a democratic right to support their team in any way they choose. We do not dictate to people what they should do, but we do encourage people to think about it. And because it is such a big collective action and because the majority are doing it, it is very effective. sadly, there are some who get quite abusive towards those who go in the ground. Likewise, some of those who go in are quite abusive towards those of us who don't. There will be wounds that need to heal once we get our football club back. But on the whole, I think most people are sort of standing together on this.
Christine, what, if anything, has the reaction of the Oystons been to the boycott? Have they responded in any way?
Well, in the early days, they tried to be very dismissive of it. They tried to portray us either as just, you know, a bit radical or a protest group, and that we were a busted flush and all these kind of things. But I think really, particularly once there was this massive court case last year, which where the minority shareholder, Valeri Belicon, who invested in the club back in 2007, he also, of course, has been let down badly by the owners. But because he has a financial interest in the club, he's been able to go to law, he's recourse to law to solve his problem. And he was awarded this staggering sum of £31.27 million. He was found to have been unfairly prejudiced by Mr. Oyston. And the evidence that came out of that, I think, really did, you know, it just supported exactly what we've been saying all along. So they basically, they still refuse really to acknowledge us. We're like a trust in exile, because most supporters' trusts, of course, are part of their football club. Mm. That's never been the case for us. I don't think they don't publicly acknowledge us, but they certainly can't ignore us, because we've been the catalyst behind uniting the fans in this action, really.
You encourage away fans to avoid spending money at the ground, like the Not a Penny More campaign. Apparently the Arsenal fans were very supportive. I mean, would you like away fans not to come at all?
Being absolutely honest, yeah, of course, that'd be absolutely marvellous. Can you imagine a totally empty ground, because fans generally were united to try and help get rid of this appalling owner because of what's happening to this Football League club that is Blackpool. However, that's not terribly realistic, and we understand that this isn't, it isn't other people's problem, it is our problem. So if you're coming to support your team, then that's fine. But whatever you can do while you're here, and so that includes not spending money in the ground, and spending it in the businesses around the club, because, of course, the area around the football club has been really badly impacted.
Yeah.
So, you know, the pubs and the fish and chip shops and the pie shops and everything would very much appreciate your business. So, you know, that's basically what we ask people to do. That's how you can show your support.
Do you miss the football, Christine?
I miss it terribly. You know, I'm a fourth generation Blackpool fan. My life was built a bit sad, really, I suppose, but it was built around the fixture list coming out every year. My whole family attended Blackpool. It's what we did. And to not do it is incredibly painful. In fact, it affects people in different ways, but I find I don't even want to watch football on the television. I mean, I was looking at some of the games last night, and you can see people, you know, look at Oldham, for example, look at the glamour of the cup and the excitement. And I just think, oh, you know, it's so long now since I've been able to do that. And it hurts. It really, really does. It's horrible. Horrible.
Look, we wish you luck, Christine.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for coming on.
No, thank you very much for having us on and listening.
Christine Seddon, the chairman of the Blackpool Supporters Trust. We should say a man was arrested after Arsenal's team bus was prevented from travelling to their FA Cup tie against Blackpool. It was a protester who sat on top of the coach. For 40 minutes, he was spoken to by officers, came down, and we do not encourage that sort of behaviour, but at the same time, it was quite funny. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Some of the other games, Man City 7, Rotherham 0. The Rotherham manager, Paul Warne, said he wasn't embarrassed by the scoreline, and he said to his players, don't waste a day. What can you learn from this? City did take it quite seriously. Phil Foden scored a cracker mark, didn't he?
Not quite. Miscontrol into the net, but I was amazed by how strong the City team was. Actually, it's the one domestic trophy Pep yet to win in England. Looks like he wants to win it. I thought we'd see a few kind of academy players, but it was only, you know, Foden, and he's not really that anymore. So no, when Rotherham saw that team sheet, I think they knew what was coming.
I think it's a real show of force from them, knowing that they can play what is essentially a full strength team because they would have another full strength team standing by.
I know. Brian Diaz has joined Real Madrid on a 6.5-year contract for £15 million, with another £6.5 million in potential add-ons, also a 15% sell-on fee. That would rise to 40% if Real sold him to United. These contracts get complex, don't they? A tweet from Jonathan O'Brien saying, yesterday Liverpool got £20 million for Solanke. Today City get £22 million for a lad who's made 5 league appearances for them in 3 years. English football is nuts. Is that nuts? It seems nuts, but... I mean, I don't know what is nuts anymore. I mean, that's when it sounds like an old man.
He's meant to be a very good player. Yeah. And he's just a very good player who can't get in an extremely good Man City team. So, I mean, it's a lot of money for someone who hasn't played a lot of games if you look at it like that. But also, if he was playing for a less good team, then yeah, fine. I think that's a fair assumption.
Man City played Burton in the Carabao Cup. Do you want to open the box, Barry?
Well, it would be a breach of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, neither to open it ahead of... Carabao Cup round.
Now, neither you or I are here on Thursday.
Mm.
So I did suggest to you before this, would it be like the Ark of the Covenant when the four people in the room are staring at the box, wondering whether to open it and what will happen?
Their faces will melt.
You can find out on Thursday. Do they dare? Well, let's leave it on the table and just see what happens. Tranmere nil, Spurs 7. Pochettino on bringing on Harry Kane at 6-0. They're not going to have many chances to see Harry Kane play here in a competition like the FA Cup. It's important to show respect to the people so they could see Harry Kane, who's an icon in English football. Sam, patronising or charming?
I would like to say that maybe a little of the charm was lost in translation. I can kind of get the sentiment. He's taking the cup seriously. He's showing respect to the team and the fans who are going there. I don't think he means it as sort of like... Oh, it's a lovely day out, and look how we've treated you. You should be thankful for us.
It's a little bit patronising, but I don't know.
I think it's one of those ones. I think that probably the Tranmere players probably appreciated it more than the Tranmere fans, who are probably just like, come on, I just want to go home now.
But all the kids, I mean, the kids who are going, Tranmere fans, will be excited to see the England captain, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and they also, I mean, Dele Alli, Kane, Pochettino were doing selfies with the crowd afterwards and signing autographs. I mean, I think that's... that's fine. I mean, there were Spurs fans doing their absolute nut on Twitter when Kane came on. You know, what's this all about? But, I mean, they would have had more intense training sessions than they probably have this week ahead of the Chelsea game. So, I mean, there's no problem with bringing him on.
Yeah, they've got Chelsea in the Carabao. Manchester United 2, Reading 0, fifth win in a row for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Barry.
Is he ever going to lose? Are Manchester United ever going to lose again? He's had a dream start against... relatively straightforward opposition. I watched that game. Reading didn't bring much to the party, to be honest. They did to an extent. They actually had more possession than Manchester United, but they had nothing in the final sort of 20 metres of the pitch. And yeah, it was a very easy win for United ultimately.
In former Manchester United player news, Wayne Rooney was arrested at Dulles International Airport on the 16th of December. After returning from a trip to Saudi Arabia, where he'd just watched the opening race of the Formula E season, he was fined $25 and paid $91 in costs after being charged with public intoxication and swearing. A regular listener to the pod, Amanda, says, who among us hasn't been drunk and sweary at the hellhole that is Dulles International Airport?
I've never been in Dulles International Airport. I'd find the fact that Wayne Rooney was on his way back from a sort of PR trip to Saudi Arabia more objectionable than him being drunk and effing and jeffing.
So did he swear at the TV? Is that the story that's come out? I think that he swore at the... He was watching Liverpool versus Man City and swore at the TV while after he'd had
this
a few beers.
This is the 16th of December. Oh, so it was Liverpool beat United.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, he's not swore at the TV. Like, I think a few people have pointed out that he was basically just arrested for being tired and English, which is, I mean, fair.
Let's be clear, this is Dulles International, not Dallas International, which is an entirely different airport.
Dulles.
Dulles, D-U-L-L-E-S.
Presume is in Washington. Because I'd actually written it down, but my handwriting is so bad now.
Where is Dulles?
I presume Virginia. It's in D.C., Virginia, is it? Okay, there we are. Hello to our American listeners. We don't know much about America. There we go. And, you know, obviously, nobody gets drunk at Dulles International Airport. It's a wonderful airport, but Dulles, terrible place.
Is it Dulles Ditchwalker?
I echo Sam's disappointment with that comment. Chelsea 2, Nottingham Forest 0. Cesc Fabregas, Mark, where does he stand in the pantheon of great midfielders in the Premier League?
Well, I'm slightly surprised that I didn't realise he was so well liked at Chelsea, but he got a very good send off. I mean, I mean, in terms of foreign Premier League players, I mean, you know, he'd definitely be sort of up there. I don't think he's Vieira, Keane. I don't think he's as good as say those two, but he's definitely in terms of representing two different teams. I've always wondered with Fabregas like what his best position is, and I have struggled to, because I mean he's played in various roles and now he's playing quite deep, isn't he, for Chelsea. I mean he's served the Premier League well. I don't think I would have gone quite so far as what the Chelsea fans did. It did seem a little OTT.
He was crying, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean he was very good in the first season at Chelsea. He was one of their key players when they won the league, and I think that as much as it's an incredibly fickle game, I think that people probably do remember that. And also, he just seems like quite a nice bloke.
He does seem quite nice.
He missed a penalty in the first half his final Chelsea appearance before he goes off to Monaco. Chelsea went around 10 million for him. It was a poor run-up, wasn't it? If you a stuttered run-up, you got a score, right?
I think they're funny. I've never seen a stuttered run-up where I've not gone, yeah, fair play. I mean,
really?
Yeah, it's a little moment in the spotlight, isn't it? I think fair enough. I think anyone who has the balls to do that, score or miss, preferably miss, because then you get to laugh a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But fun, isn't it?
I suppose it's the entertainment business.
You know
it?
What it is? It's sports entertainment. Everything is wrestling, and he's just having a laugh. He's out there having a laugh on his last big day out.
Alvaro Morata isn't having a laugh. Even when he scores, he looks sad. Barry.
Well, he got two goals and still sort of emerged as a sort of comically tragic figure. The highlight of this game for me was him appealing for VAR in a game which VAR was not being used. Quite apart from the fact that it's a bookable offence to appeal for VAR, you know, you'd think he would know whether or not the service was available before requesting it by making the rectangle.
Do you think it should still be a bookable offence if there is no VAR?
I would argue it's possibly a red card offence.
So was it? I think it was Hamsik last year for Napoli, scored a goal, kicked the corner flag, was booked, and then it was disallowed by VAR. So he ended up with a booking and no goal. This reminded me of the Crystal Palace game where Morata, you know, did well in terms of the goals, and yet he's remembered for, you know, the miss, which was offside. But it's the same thing against Palace, wasn't it, when he tried to chip the goalkeeper right at the end?
Yes.
And it feels like he can't do any right at Chelsea and needs to move on, because this... I know the narrative was one of the things that one listener wanted kicked out of the pod in 2019, but the narrative is that Morata is a failure at Chelsea and just will be a failure at Chelsea, and it's difficult to see him shaking that off.
I think it also comes down to, I mean, playing to his strengths as well. I mean, Hudson-Odoi did it twice and he scored two goals from it. I think he's very good if you're going to be playing that type of football, which Sarri doesn't usually play at all.
We might not have Hudson-Odoi to do it.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
That is a strange. It seems strange. You sort of think you've got a player who looks really good. We were talking about Ramsey last week as well. If somebody like Bayern Munich wants them, you should just check to see if he is really good again.
They're not stupid. Like they clearly know he's a very good player, but he just doesn't fit the system. I think it's probably the same thing as Cesc Fabregas. Hasn't quite got the legs of Jorginho. Would be playing a similar role, and just kind of gone, yeah, they're good, but it just doesn't quite work.
Hmm. You can understand why fans get so upset with a young academy product again, right?
The fans, and also, if you're in that academy, I mean, it'd just be another kick in the balls.
You'd be like, why am I here?
Yeah, I mean, because there's no pathway. If Hudson-Odoi can't get in, then, you know, he's meant to be the pick of them.
Mm.
Then, I mean, what chance of any of them? What is the point of that academy?
Well, there's a pathway to Bayern Munich, right? I mean, that's not a bad pathway.
No, but I think that you would lose heart. I mean, presumably they all want to kind of be the next John Terry within that sort of Chelsea system and come through, and the fans would want to see some of that as well. And so I think it's a failure on Chelsea's part if they lose him.
I think the thing is as well, when they leave Chelsea now, they look burnt out, like they've just had like the life sucked out of them. You look at like Chalobah yesterday, just looks like a shell of a man after having like the life just sort of squeezed out of him season after season, just sitting there watching Chelsea. And like, It's not good in the long run for English football. It's also not good for those players because, yeah, you can go to Bayern Munich and, yeah, the lucky few may do. But, like, you look at a lot of the players. I mean, Kevin De Bruyne luckily escaped the clutches of being a young player at Chelsea. But there's plenty who move on and are just so burnt by the situation. Mm. You can just see that they're just depressed by it.
Right, the last of the upsets, Norwich 0, Portsmouth 1. A 94th minute winner for Andre Green and quite a funny red card for Grant Hanley, which I think Daniel Farke's trying to appeal. I'm not sure how he'll do that. Daniel says, Norwich had a flag and a singing section at the game on Saturday. Thoughts on trying to artificially help the atmosphere at games?
I can see, I commend the sentiment, but it does come across as a bit crap, doesn't it? Contrived and twee.
But forced fun? Do you like forced fun, Barry?
I don't. Forced jollity is one of my major peeves.
Just
jollity in general.
I was going to say, Accrington Stanley 1, Ipswich 0. We've not even put that in an upsets category. The commentator on English telly saying, Ipswich have gone out in the third round of the last 8 seasons. It can only get better from here. Well, actually, it could get worse because they are now been knocked out for the third round in 9 seasons after losing at Accrington. They're really struggling.
And they'll probably be in the first round next year, given their league position.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Mm. Crystal Palace 1, Grimsby 0. A VAR red card, Grimsby, in 2 minutes in. Fair enough.
Oh, it was, yeah. Absolutely.
And well done to Jordan Ayew, who scored a goal. Not perhaps as well done to Wayne Hennessy. His German teammate, Max Meyer, posts a picture from a team dinner in which Hennessy appears to be doing a Nazi salute in the background. He took to Twitter to give this explanation. Wayne says, yesterday evening I had a meal with my teammates and we had a group photograph. I waved and shouted at the person taking the picture to get on with it and at the same time put my hand over my mouth to make the sound carry. It's been brought to my attention that frozen in a moment by the camera, this looks like I'm making a completely inappropriate type of salute. I can assure everyone I would never do that and any resemblance to that kind of gesture is absolutely coincidental. Love and peace, Wayne. It's one hell of a coincidence, Barry, isn't it?
Yeah.
The bit that really gets me is love and peace at the end, like he's George Harrison.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, I mean, come on, mate. Not saying just come out and say, look, I was trying to be funny, winding up my friend, didn't think this picture was going to be on there. Sorry, that was stupid. Love and peace, Wayne Hennessy.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, I now understand. Oh,
I am working on the assumption, I hasten to add, that Wayne Hennessy is not a neo-Nazi.
Yeah, that is a possibility, but we don't know. We presume
I'm
not.
I'm pretty certain he
is. Also, how quiet is his voice as a goalkeeper? Surely goalkeeper should be quite loud.
Maybe that's been the problem.
Do you know what I mean?
QPR 2, Leeds 1. Jack Pitbrook writing, QPR win an FA Cup game without a replay for the first time since the Trevor Sinclair bicycle kick against Barnsley. Is that serious?
Yes, mad that. I've got a couple of mates who were there and Leeds being quite good, QPR being quite bad, notoriously so in the third round, I think that they all thought they were going to get absolutely hammered.
But that's a very long time, isn't it? Woking 0, Watford 2. You met the Woking manager, didn't you?
Alan Dowson, yeah. Mm. I've met him a few times when he was at Hampton and Richmond and always a nice bloke, always straight in the pub after full time, which is nice. But yeah, I spoke to him at the third round draw and very openly, very honestly said, not going to be one of these managers that lie to you. We're going to get fucking battered. and out of politeness, I took out the F word and just to soften it a little. But it was just, I mean, he's just a very straight talking manager, obviously. And you can see it after the game. You can see the way that the team was set up. They are all very aware of their place in football. And he's quite an unsentimental manager. And I thought they gave a great account of themselves.
And, hey, really fun to see Martin Tyler
in it
on the touchline. I thoroughly enjoyed that. West Ham 2, Birmingham City 0. Fun to see Arnautovic being hauled off and being absolutely furious and Pellegrini sort of laughing nervously as he walked past him.
Yeah, very strange, really. I mean, he'd obviously... they were worried about his fitness. I mean, Arnautovic needs to realise that there's more important things than him scoring another goal against Birmingham and that the rest of the season is still going on. I mean, it's typical of Arnautovic and probably explains why he's had the career he's had, really, because he could have done more, but he's...
Well, he was just angry he got a substitute. It's not that bad.
Yeah, but he was clear... He, he's thinking of himself rather than the team, isn't he?
I think as a player, he sort of always needs something to rally against. So as a West Ham fan, I'm quite excited. Hopefully he just comes out and he's really annoyed in the next game.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, yeah, he's an absolutely brilliant player. I think he could play for, you know, a Manchester United or Chelsea for sure.
Interesting. Burnley 1, Barnsley 0. This was some great VAR, Barry, wasn't it?
Well, it was wonderful for many reasons. Sean Dyche is constantly whinging about the fact that Burnley never get penalties. And then they finally do get one, and it's overturned by VAR, which Sean Dyche is always extolling the virtues of. And not only was it was overturned mid-run-up, which was just wonderful. So I was slightly disappointed when Burnley got another penalty, which enabled them to win the game. But there you go, such is life.
Dyche sort of calmed down by the end and said, look, once they've ironed out VAR, it'll be a good thing. I mean, personally, I'm a big fan of it mid-run-up, you know. It's just the timing was absolutely, it was poetic, wasn't it? Millwall 2, Hull City 1, two lovely goals to Shane Ferguson. And Steve Morrison is still playing, Barry. That's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bournemouth 1, Brighton 3, one of only two all Premier League ties in the third round. Wolves and Liverpool lock horns tonight. Otherwise wins for West Brom, Bolton, Brentford, AFC Wimbledon, Middlesbrough, Swansea, Everton 2, Lincoln 1, and Lincoln put up a pretty good fight. You were there, Sam.
Yeah, I was. I was in with the Imps in the 5,500 that they brought down, and can't say that they tested Pickford much apart from the goal. But considering it was Everton's pretty much a full-strength team, they won. Everton looked bad, and also Lincoln looked not comfortable, but like, they weren't like that far under pressure, and I was just really impressed. But without getting into magic of the cup territory, I think it was just a prime example of Danny Cowley and the Cowleys being great managers and having sort of provenance in that competition. The team sort of having confidence in themselves, and also the fans just being like enormous. They were fantastic the whole game, and as soon as they knew that they were going to lose, and I mean it was pretty obvious that they weren't going to win. They were still singing about being top of the league and just completely undimmed. And it was just like a real joy to be there and to be able to talk to the fans.
Doncaster of League One, won at Championship Preston. Well done, Donny. John Marquis has scored a lot of goals for them. He looks like the League One Andy Carroll to me. A couple of replays will be Sheffield Wednesday, Luton and Newcastle Blackburn. And that's the FA Cup. In the Football League, three games in League One, wins for Burton and Scunthorpe, while fourth place Charlton and third place Sunderland drew 1-1. You were there, Mark.
I was, yeah. Cliche game of two halves. I mean, Sunderland were really the dominant force in that first period. Got the goal from O'Neill, had a couple of opportunities to go further ahead. Second half, though, completely different story. Charlton went more direct up to Lyle Taylor, who forced the equaliser via an own goal, and then they passed up a number of opportunities to win. To me, it was probably a fair result. They both look top six teams, but maybe not good enough for automatic, which could see a repeat of the playoff final, of course, of, was it 20 years ago?
Oh, God. Look at the pain in your face, Barry, at the thought of it.
Well, Sunderland could be in bother now because their striker, Josh Madger, who anyone who's watched Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix will know, was sort of introduced to the first team in the back end of last season after Lewis Grabban decided to bugger off and end his loan spell. He scored, I think, 14 league goals this season, 15 in all competitions, and he has decided, well, his agent has told Stuart Donald at Sunderland that he won't be signing a new contract. There was talk linking him with Crystal Palace, which Roy Hodgson greeted quite quizzically, saying that he'd never even heard of Josh Madger. So I think Stuart Donald is quite optimistic that he can get him to change his mind and sign on for the rest of the season, or stay for the rest of the season. They've offered him, I think, seven times his current salary. I don't know what that is, but he seems to have notions above his station. Well, I don't know if they're above his station or not, but you know, it's basically he's a rookie. He's having a good time of it, but yeah, if they lose him, it could be in trouble because I think their next highest scorer is Aidan McGeady, who only has seven.
I think they're he's on sort of football terms, he's on a tiny amount of money, which is maybe one of the problems. But the Sunderland fans, there have been a suggestion that they boo him or try to unsettle him maybe ahead of that game at the Valley. But when his name was read out, there was a really big cheer towards him. So the Sunderland fans are doing all they can to try to get him to stay.
Excellent weekend in League Two. Bury moved into the top three with a win at lowly Yeovil. Yeovil are so bad. Cambridge are now above them. After we smashed Stevenage 2-0, Colin Calderwood's Amber Army. Bottom side, Notts County were 3-1 up at Colchester, but ended up drawing 3-3, while Sol Campbell's Macclesfield lost at home to Swindon. So a very good weekend for Cambridge United, which I'm pleased about, even if it means nothing to, I'd say, 99.9% of the audience. Worrying story from women's football. The FA has launched an investigation after a Spurs ladies footballer alleged that monkey noises were directed at her by an opposition player during a game on Sunday. The Spurs centre-back Rene Hector said on Twitter the noises had been made by a Sheffield United player during their 2-1 win in the FA Women's Championship. So we'll let you know what happens with that. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we will begin in Spain with Sid. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's go to Spain and say hello to Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous, thanks. Are we at crisis now for Real Madrid? They lost 2-0 to Real Sociedad.
Well, I mean, I suppose we are. Although, in a way, we kind of already were. Although, what this does is reinforce that. They've now obviously come back from the World Club Championships. They're world champions and a European champion. So, I suppose, on one level at least, it's not much of a crisis. But they've come back and they drew with Villarreal and they were beaten 2-0 by Real Sociedad this weekend. But what made it so striking was that after the Villarreal defeat, the Villarreal draw, there are a lot of fingers pointing at Santi Solari, the manager, for probably the first time, I think, that they were directly aimed at him. And it felt like it happened very quickly, and it felt like it happened in a way that was almost coordinated. And obviously at Real Madrid, then when that happens, managers tend to fear the worst. Solari then said, look, I think people are perhaps underestimating the importance or the value of draws. You know, going away to Villarreal and drawing 2-2 is not that bad. Now, of course, that may well be true, and it may well be a relatively rational thing to say, but it's not the kind of thing you say when you're Real Madrid manager. This caused a huge kind of backlash against Solari. Big headline in Marca the following morning: Solari, you're at Real Madrid. You know, this is Real Madrid. You can't say that a draw is ever good enough. I mean, not even in a Clásico, still less away at Villarreal. And so then, as if to prove the point that a draw's not that bad, the following day they lost 2-0.
Would they be in danger of not qualifying for the Champions League? That's when it's real crisis, right?
Yeah, that, absolutely. And one or two of the Madrid supporting columnists this morning have been saying, look, let's not kid ourselves now. The key now is to qualify for that Champions League place, that final Champions League place. Obviously, Barcelona ahead of them, Sevilla ahead of them, Atletico Madrid ahead of them. You would expect that. The team that you wouldn't expect to be ahead of them is Alaves, a team who started the season saying that our only objective has to be to survive. They're only 1 point ahead. And obviously, you look at it rationally and you think, well, Alaves won't stay there, so they should get that final place. But I guess if things do get really bad, then perhaps that question will be asked. And Solari, as I say, I think part of this, the context of this is that he was having the finger pointed at him for the first time. And he said in the build-ups this weekend's game, he said, look, I took the team over and we were in ninth place and we're now fourth. Well, they've gone back down to fifth. So that kind of argument has been slightly diminished. And also, he also took over the team 7 points behind Barcelona. They're now 10 points behind Barcelona. If you look at the teams they've played, the eight sides they've played in La Liga, all of them are 11th or lower in the table. So even though they were picking up victories, none of these results were impressing anyone. It doesn't impress anyone to win 2-0 against Valladolid playing dreadfully. It doesn't impress anyone to win 1-0 against Rayo Vallecano or 1-0 against Huesca. And so the pressure was on, and there was a sense that nothing was really improving. But there's also that question mark about, well, how much does it change things if you change the manager? And Modric was very, very good last night. And in part last night, the focus has been on the fact that Madrid were denied what looked like a fairly clear penalty. And perhaps most importantly, the VAR didn't even intervene. And a lot of people are saying, well, this is, how can it be that the VAR doesn't even intervene? Whether you can debate whether you think it's a penalty or not, but the VAR certainly was enough of a penalty to look at it. But I think Modric came out and I think probably said it right. We can talk about this, but we've got to talk about ourselves. There isn't enough unity on the pitch. We need to sit down and discuss why this is happening. We can't always just point at the manager. We're not scoring enough goals. That's our big problem, but it's not our only problem. And he said, we can't have a cock-up every game, which is basically what's been happening.
At the bottom of the table, second win for Huesca. There's still a few points adrift of Rayo Vallecano and Atletico Bilbao.
Yeah, their first ever win in the first division at home. Of course, they won on the first day of the season. I was there to see them beat Eibar on the first day, and they hadn't won since. A really big surprise this, and they're playing against a Betis side who was seventh, who were playing pretty well. That said, Huesca are not as bad as their position suggests, certainly not over the last couple of months, certainly since Francisco has taken over as manager, but they're a long, long way adrift. It's going to be a really interesting season at the bottom, you know, because Villarreal are very definitely in trouble. Athletic Bilbao are very definitely in trouble. These are two big teams, you know, two European teams in recent years. And so it's going to be very, very tight to see who eventually goes down. But my guess is that Huesca will go, Rayo Vallecano will go, and then one other will go. And as I say, there's two very, very big teams that are pretty strong candidates to do it now.
We've mentioned this before in relation to Antoine Griezmann, but Andres Iniesta has tweeted a picture of, I presume, his family, two of whom, friends or family, two of whom are blacked up. And I know you sort of mentioned before that it's wrongly viewed differently, right?
Yeah, it's difficult for me to give anything like what will feel like a remotely satisfactory answer to this in a way, because of course it's just a totally different way of looking at it, and it's just not even really considered. I think in the last 4 or 5 years this kind of question has been raised a bit. To put it into its proper context, the biggest day of the year in Spain, the kind of the Christmas day, is King's Night, when supposedly the three kings arrive in Bethlehem and bring their gifts to the baby Jesus and blah blah blah. And those three kings in Spain, always two of them are white and one of them is black. Now, obviously, in a country that hasn't had a black population for a very, very, very long time, the one that was black blacked up. And that's still done. And it's genuinely not even considered a thing. Although, as I say, I think in the last 3 or 4 years, that question has been raised a bit. And that question has been raised about, okay, in all of these King's Parades, and there are King's Parades all over Spain in every little town, we need to start making it so that the person who goes as the black of the three kings has to be, you know, we can't have people blacked up. But generally, in fact, I think this is almost entire right across the board, I would say, most people just not consider that to be problematic. And as I say, I think this is a process that perhaps has begun now, but has still got a very, very, very long way to run.
Sid, thanks so much for coming on, as always.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain. From Sid Lowe to Frank Ribery. This is a fun story, isn't it? He bought a very expensive piece of meat, a steak which cost £267, which somebody, and you'll need to educate me here, I believe you all know who Salt Bay is. I'm not aware of Salt Bay, but he's a professional social media meat cutter-upper, is he? What's he do?
He's professionally handsome Turkish chef.
Oh, right, okay. So he cooked the steak. It's coated with gold.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good to me. I don't know. I've not had that much gold in my diet.
When you look
it's called leaf, I think. Doesn't it come in? Is it Jägermeister, the drink?
There's the vodka that's got like bits of gold in it.
But when you order a steak, and it, you know, they say peppercorn, mushroom, garlic butter, or béarnaise, gold is not on. It's not generally on the list of the menus.
No, it isn't.
Anyway, he got a lot of abuse because he did this sort of showy video with his £267 steak, and then he posted the following on Instagram. For 2019, let's dot the I's and cross the T's. Let's start with the jealous, the haters, those clearly born from a condom with a hole in it. Fuck your mothers, your grandmothers, and even your family. I owe you nothing. My success is above all thanks to God, me, and my loved ones who believed in me. For the others, you're nothing but pebbles in my socks. So sort of diplomatically, he didn't do peace and love at the end of that.
No, he didn't. There is always that.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it?
Well, I have a certain regard for people who just don't give a shit what other people think of them. It's often very commendable. But, yeah, it kind of reminds me of Father Ted's golden cleric acceptance speech, you know, and now the liars. But, yeah, it's not a hill I'd have chosen to die on, really, you know, getting that upset about what people thought of my choice for dinner.
He's been fined by Bayern Munich for his language on social media. But it's very strange because a lot of footballers and ex-footballers go to this restaurant and have the steak and put it on Instagram, and they don't seem to get the abuse. So it's strange that Ribéry has received enough that he's responded in this manner.
Was it from French fans that he was mostly getting abuse? Because, I mean,
because of how the steak was cooked.
Yeah, were they just gastronomically offended?
Appalled.
It wasn't rare enough.
No.
I have to say that while I do commend him for not giving a shit, he does appear to very much give one.
He's taken the knock there, isn't he? Yeah.
Here's a question from Tommy. It says, is Michael Owen football's biggest ever shithouse? See the Jason McAteer incident? Well done, he's 13, with reference to that amazing video of him scoring one-on-ones past the 13-year-old goalkeeper with Neville Southall being truly unimpressed and shamelessly signing for Man United. This is in the Soccer Sixes Vets five-a-side or six-a-side, I imagine, up in Scotland, I think it is, and it was on Sky, and Michael Owen savagely hacks Jason McAteer down. Jason McAteer reacts with a sort of gentle kick to his backside. McAteer gets a red and Owen gets a yellow, which is...
McAteer pulls him first, which is why Owen kicks him.
Yeah, he does. But and also, anyone who's not lashed out at five-a-side doesn't want to win five-a-side enough for me. But also, I think that Jason McAteer's gentle kick up the arse was a kick up the arse. I don't think it was as gentle as he made out.
So it's two reds, isn't it? Robbie Fowler tweeted Jason McAteer, say, what's happened tonight, mate? I've missed it, crying with laughter emoji. So Jason McAteer tweeted, so me and Michael Owen has a scuffle and he launched me, then I softly kicked him up the hoop. The piss poured officials, it's a very sweary podcast, I'm really sorry everyone, the poor officials decided they didn't see his challenge but still give him a yellow card. I got a red. Simples. It's great, isn't it?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, this is exactly what the Soccer Sixes need.
But I agree with you. People who get that angry at six-a-side are people who don't play 11-a-side.
Yeah.
So it's basically, he doesn't have real football anymore. And so, because when I play six-a-side and people care what the score is, I'm like, why do you care? This is just a kickabout. But that's their 11-a-side for them.
Yeah, that's the most passion I've seen from anyone in an Ireland shirt for a very long time.
And finally, the diet of Mark Langdon. We established last time, Sam, you weren't here, that... you weren't here either,
Barry. No, I wasn't here either.
Mark didn't have carrots or parsnips on his Christmas dinner. He shaped sausage meat into the shape of carrots and parsnips while also having pigs in blankets. And he hasn't eaten a vegetable for months.
For months, and fruit for months. I have a very sort of Argentinian sort of diet that involves a lot of meat and not much else.
Have you had any vegetables since the last pod?
No. I've had a few roast dinners with more sausage meat, but no veg.
Any fruit?
No.
How are you feeling? Maybe you've like hacked diets.
I feel good. I feel
good. Human.
Yeah.
And are you regular?
Yes. Somebody was very concerned about my toilet habits, but it's all good.
To be honest, mate, with that much meat, I'm a little bit concerned.
Do you take like any supplements or anything?
No, I don't feel the need to. I'm fine working order.
And what did you have for lunch yesterday?
Doner meat and chips.
It's a great lunchtime meal, isn't it?
With burger sauce.
And dinner?
That was chicken fajitas with no peppers or anything like that, just a chicken, cheese, sauce and the wraps.
Is it like a conscious thing? Were there peppers in it and you went, fuck peppers?
No, I just told my wife, can you just cook them without the peppers? So she does her one separate and then my one with no peppers.
I'm just checking the ingredients to burger sauce because I fear...
Oh, is there veg in there? Wait, have I got some of my five a day?
I think it's just tomato and mayonnaise.
Well, this one has mayonnaise, ketchup, so I'm going to be some tomatoes, pickle relish, that's got to be full of celery and...
Well, there we go. The five a day is being...
I normally sit in the pod and think how Barry's alive is a surprise, but frankly, you're a beacon of health compared to Mark Landon. How you are... You look very fit and healthy. It's a surprise.
I don't know what to say about
that. If you would like to post any vegetables to Mark Langdon, send them to The Guardian and we will pass them on. Or like a little, one of those boxes that arrives. Be lovely, wouldn't it? That'll do for today. Sam, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
I'm off for three pods. Going to see my wife, see if she recognises me. In the meantime, the excellent Mel Rudd and Faye Carruthers will be sitting in this chair. Be nice to them. But don't, that doesn't mean you abuse me for not being, which has already happened. Right, well, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.